Please join me in welcoming our main speakers, Harry and Sierra Mosley. Hi, everybody. I'm Harry. I'm an alcoholic. Nice to be here tonight. I want to thank Gail for the invitation to be up here with you. I want to say welcome to Derek. We're glad you're here. Hugh, thank you for a great share. His story is like really a lot more exciting than mine. I'm just here to tell you right now that I could have listened to you for another 40 minutes. Thank you so much for your share. And happy birthday to all the birthday people. And my takeaway from that is, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous is working really well up in the Royal Grande, you know, and that's what happens if you stick around and stay and do the work, as it was mentioned by Q tonight. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. Everything good in my life I owe to this program. And what I also want to say about that is every challenging or difficult thing that I've walked through, I have been able to do it entirely differently than the way it was when I hit walls and problems when I was still drinking. I've been able to walk through a lot of things that were challenging with dignity and grace. I can tell you that you can align, you know, hard, sad times with faith and serenity. I have been able to align, you know, some tragedies that I have called tragedies that have occurred in my life or around my life with joy. And this is all a direct result of Alcoholics Anonymous, the steps, the principles, the traditions, this loving God that I have found through the spiritual awakening that I have come to know one day at a time as a continued journey by the work that I'm still willing to do. So with that, I will tell you that I have a sobriety date, and it's April 19th, 1987. I've been sober 37 and a half years. Okay. It is important for me to have that date. My story, and it may not be yours, is I came in and I stayed. Now, I am of the opinion that I had to go through every single difficult, pitiful, and incomprehensible, demoralizing thing that I went through in order for me to be out of every single idea that I kept coming up with, you know. And I guess I was ready. So I hope it's your time and I hope you stay. I am a believer that the miracle started to take place for me the morning I came to in April of 1987, one more time, in a strange place with a strange person coming off the dance floor earlier that night, you know, coming to one more time with alcohol poisoning, you know, and the language that took place that morning in that bathroom of that stranger's house, you know, when I said, God, I can't live like this anymore. Please help me. You know, the alcoholic prayer. My miracle was taking place. So I hope that if you're here and you're new, I know Derek's new, if there's anybody else here that's new or kind of new, or if you're here and you're not so new and you're going through something challenging or difficult, don't go anywhere. You know, tradition one talks about, you know, together we can walk through anything. Alone we're going to die. You know, and I've been around long enough to know that untreated alcoholism, you know, jails, institutions, and death. And the other thing that I've witnessed is that, you know, the door doesn't always swing both ways. It just doesn't always swing both ways. So I have that sobriety date. I am actively sponsored after all these years. And what that means to me is that my sponsor knows she's my sponsor. And I see my sponsor once a week, minimally, at our Wednesday night home group meeting. You know, I fight through a huge meeting to get to her just to get a quick hug. She's very popular at the meeting, and that's usually the best I get. But it is important for me to see her, to lock eyes with her. She'll ask me, how are you doing? I say, great, good to see you, hug, and move on. I have home group meetings. I have three live meetings that I attend, my Wednesday night Pacific Group meeting in Culver City, my Thursday night Rose City Speakers meeting in Pasadena, my Sunday morning TV Van Nuys meeting in Sherman Oaks, called Van Nuys, but it's in Sherman Oaks. And then I do two meetings on Zoom, second and fourth Sunday of the month, where we study literature with the women I sponsor and the women they sponsor and any other women that would like to join us. And alternative to that, I have two meetings that I attend on Zoom to my old friend and former sponsor that she had that meeting up. She's got a disease. I'm totally blanking out. Anyway, she doesn't go out of the house anymore. But I'm with her on those alternative Sunday nights, and we have a meeting like that. So that's what's going on. I sponsor women. It is important for me to try to help others. The book talks about it. The book talks about if I want to stay here, you know, I'm going to have to give away what I've been so freely given over the last 37 and a half years. Speaking at a podium is not really what I think is my jam, and I much rather be sitting down with another alcoholic, opening a book and going through and helping them with the steps and, you know, just kind of maneuvering life on life's terms with people. And I do sponsor a lot of women, and I'm really grateful for that, because I will tell you, over the years, and particularly over the last few years, which I may even start off with the last few years of my sobriety, because what I don't want to do is run out of time. Which sometimes I run a little long on what it was like and what happened. I am going to tell you a couple stories about that, because I think it's important. Because when I came in to my first meeting, and my second meeting particularly, it was not anybody standing at the podium that was talking about, you know, the amazing, you know, steps and traditions that really drew me in. It was the woman that talked about the story of pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, remorse, and shame and guilt. I heard that. And when she said those words, I thought, I know those words, but who put them all in a sentence like that? You know, I did in that moment. And then she said she wasn't drinking anymore because of Alcoholics Anonymous. And then she really grabbed me when she said, and she was happy. And it's all I ever wanted. I just wanted to be happy. I just wanted to just be quiet, you know, and that is where I was just sucked right in, just like that. But I am going to go back for a couple minutes and give you a little bit of background. I grew up in a very dysfunctional alcoholic home, okay? It's not what makes me an alcoholic, but I was very ashamed of that home, and I had a whole lot of secrets. I had two parents. I had a younger brother. I knew I was loved. I thought I had the worst home life ever growing up. Until I came into the rooms of AA, and I thought, oh my gosh, you know, there's people that have just like taught me out tenfold, you know. But it was a little rough. Both parents had alcoholism, and both parents were untreated. And, you know, my parents actually divorced when I was 3, and they went back and forth with each other until I was about 19 years old. You know, my mom needed Alcoholics Anonymous, and she also needed Al-Anon, I think, you know, and so it got kind of rough. You know, there were many nights where I can't remember a night where my parents were together and we were drinking together, and, you know, violence didn't break out. And I was a kid that was laying in my bed waiting to hear either the screaming or the dead, scary silence. And it's, you know, 7, 8, 9 years old, I'm jumping out of bed and I'm breaking up these adults, and sometimes it was really rough, you know, like, you know, my dad was physical, my mom had a really sharp mouth. I inherited a little bit of each of that in my alcoholism, by the way, in case I don't tell a story that kind of demonstrates that, and then nobody ever talked about it the next day. So I was really embarrassed by that, and it is what it was. It did not make me an alcoholic. It may have sort of got me sort of ready for the journey that I ended up eventually getting to in our other program. But so there was that, and I tried to overcompensate with I was just uncomfortable in my own skin. I never felt enough. It's very common to hear people talk about that at the podium, and that was me. I just wasn't enough. And more importantly, you weren't enough. You know, I was sort of a victim from as far back as I can remember. And, you know, the one thing about victimization that I found out after I got to alcoholics, I mean, I just rode the coattails of being a victim my entire life, all the way into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And then I got caught around here through the steps and my sponsor and just hearing all the stories that, you know, being a victim is just, you know, the slow roll to a resentment. And what does the big book tell me? Resentment's the number one offender. It takes out more people than anybody else. So even after I got sober and was sober for a little while, I had to really work on backing off on the idea that, you know, you're doing it to me, he's doing it to me. You know, they're not treating me right in that meeting. I'm just like, but it's historical for me to to understand that you don't treat me the way I need to be treated. You know, and then, you know, on top of that, I'm kind of controlling and bossy, and I'm very manipulative, and, you know, I'm trying to excel at everything I do in my, this is elementary school, by the way, academics. I was in academics. I wanted to do good. I was pretty good, except for in math, where I was always cheating and copying off Gloria Rodarte's math paper. Everything else I was really good at. And then I was a natural athlete, and we didn't have AYSO and girls softball and all that kind of stuff. I would play baseball with the boys, and I skateboarded, and I played football with the boys, and we did a lot of track meets, inner city track meets, and I participated in all the different sports. And here's a snapshot of self-entitlement, because I was always so self-entitled. This is all part of what was getting me, thank God, to that first strength. I was on the same track team for 3 years, and in elementary school, and we had a four-way girls relay team, and we would always ribbon in it, always, you know, often first place. But, you know, when I did my first inventory, on that first inventory was Deanne, Melinda, and my coach. Because nobody could recognize how good I was, so they kept putting me in the second and third spot and know that the fastest runners are in the first and fourth spot. I mean, I'm giving you a demonstration of how weird my head is very early on. And, you know, it was never enough for me to be a part of something successful like that. I want you to see how brilliant I am. And I was being shortchanged there. You know, I should have been in Melinda's spot, or I should have been in Deanne's spot. So, you know, this kind of ties in a little bit, you guys, and I'm going to talk about a couple things that happened while I was under the influence here in just a second. But, you know, my disease is centered in my mind. It is about ego. It's about pride. It's about not what you're not doing enough for me. It's always somebody, people, places, and things are just the core of my dilemma. And so I finally got to a drink at 11. And what I want to say, I do remember my first drink, and my first drink was not a blackout. I was with a young couple that I babysat for. I was 11 going on 14. She brought her cute 14-year-old brother with us, and we went to the beach, and we were allowed to have one glass of an alcoholic beverage. It was a mixed drink with, like, hard liquor and sweet stuff. And mine was in a purple. I still remember the tumbler. It was a plastic ribbed tumbler, and I drank it down. And, you know, the book talks about what alcohol does to me. I drink for the effect. And that night was magical. And, you know, for a long time, I had quite a high tolerance to alcohol. I could drink a lot of you guys under the table, I'll tell you that. That guy right there, you right there, you know. And I drank that, and it was just magical for me. And in that moment, I could flirt. I was enough. I didn't realize that was all going on, but as I look back on it, when I started to learn about my disease, and when I started working the steps with my sponsor, and I started, you guys told me my story over and over again when I was new, I realized that the magic of alcohol transformed me in that night. And although I didn't start off an absolute wreck, I can tell you right there, I am convinced that because of that effect produced, I was mentally obsessed for the next 19 years. And if I was not drinking, I was thinking about the next time I was going to drink. And so in that regard, I kind of crossed that line right then and there. For the sake of time, I'm going to speed right up and tell you that I made it through several years. A little rocky. It's hard to go into middle school. I became a parent in sobriety, and when my kids got to seventh grade, eighth grade, and I sort of thought about what I was doing then, and I'm watching these little babies of mine growing up, and it was just insane that I was doing as much as I was doing in middle school. But I immediately, from the first time I drank, started to move things out of the way to get to where I wanted to get, which was drinking and boys. Okay, I made it through high school. They were going to throw me out of school. I shipped back into gear. I am like that chameleon. We used to talk a lot about how we're chameleons, and we can change colors, and we can get into groups, and we can be whoever you need us to be to get what we want. I was always like that. I can be what you need me to be in order for me to get. I've always got a motive case. So, you know, I can convince you of whatever you need me to be so I can get what I get. But really, what started to happen early on is I start moving things out, things that I aspired to be, that school teacher that I was planning on being, you know, to be a good partner with somebody, to be that star athlete, all those things. All that stuff started to get in the way of my drinking. There's a story in the back of the big book. It's not freedom of choice, freedom from bondage. There's another one. And it talks about, as alcoholics, we shift our lives around in order to get to the drink, you know, as opposed to the normal people that are going to set drinking aside to achieve our goals, a lot like what she talked about. And I was doing that right off the bat. And, you know, so I put everything on hold to get through school. Back when I was in high school, you could get sort of trades almost. And I became a stenographer, and I ended up at 18 years old working in Mayor Bradley's office down in Los Angeles. He was the first black mayor. It was kind of an exciting time in 1974, 75. And I started making a lot of money. My life looked good on the outside. I had a great boyfriend. I had good friends. I was not drinking into blackouts or doing any of the things that I was going to be starting to do in the next 2.5 years. And if it would have stayed like that, I probably would have fallen into that characterization of like a heavy drinker. But the outside stuff was coming together. They promoted me at work. I was in the throes of a lot of excitement under the guise of Mayor Bradley, and life was good, you know. But what I will tell you here is by the time when I went into a bar on my 21st birthday, I called somebody up to take me there. I had already started to drink by the time I was 21 into blackouts. And with that came those things like pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, blackout drunk driving, you know, face-to-face with the law on several occasions behind my drinking. Now, I will tell you, I wrangled my way out of those situations, and you don't have, you know, if you're sitting here thinking I didn't go to prison or I didn't go to jail, you know, those were some of the things were on my not yet list. So although I was a bad blackout drunk driver, it was one of the things that made me feel so shameful. And towards the end of my drinking, I'm going to tell you, I would sit there thinking, if I take that first drink tonight, I don't stay home and drink. And I was doing a lot of drinking by myself at that point. That way I did not have to explain myself to anybody I knew, which was, we were talking earlier, my friends from people here from Los Angeles that I know and that live up here now, and how, you know, I like to go to Mexico. So I can go down to Mexico and I can buy prescription drugs with no prescriptions, and I can drink real cheap. And I can do all the things that I do as a drunken woman and experience that pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization that I was experiencing, and hopefully not run into any of those people I was seeing in Mexico back home when I get home, you know. And but I knew that I was going to be drinking and driving, and yet, you know, and thinking that I could possibly go out and kill somebody, it was not enough to stop me at that point because I had lost the power of choice. And it was not the 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th, 13th, 14th shot of tequila or whatever I was on that night. It was the first drink. Once I took that first drink, I'm done for. And I'm putting people in danger all over the place by drinking. You know, the things that, you know, I had lots of nice relationships. I was a liar. I was a cheat. I lost jobs. That job in Mayor Bradley's office, I left before I could get fired. I had gotten 2 really significant promotions, and after that, my drinking had gotten so, my life was so unmanageable. Not only my drinking, but the way I perceived the things around me. Because again, remember, for me, alcoholism centers my mind and my spirit, and I treat it with alcoholism, with alcohol. But of course, now I've lost the ability to control in my drinking, and all bets are off on everything I'm doing. So I will tell you that in November of 1981, because I didn't get another promotion, because that lousy fiancé that I had been with was such a loser, I had to get out of there. I had a resentment with the mayor because they were not giving me the next promotion. You know, Los Angeles was the problem, the job's the problem, my friends were giving me the stink eye about my behavior, blaming me for stuff. You know, there wasn't one thing that I ever took responsibility for on my own until I came into Alcoholics Anonymous and I got to look at that first fourth step with my sponsor, which was life-changing, the fourth column, of course, which I call the freedom column. When she took me through this and got to help me see what my part had been and that had been a common denominator out of every single resentment that I had on that list. You know, and that's where the freedom really starts to happen around here, when you start to get in these steps and you can see that stuff, you know, that you know, the way we lived, the way we treated people, the people we harmed, the resentments we had that was so desperate and horrible, you know, and all of that stuff. So in November of 1981, I actually was going to ditch LA because that was the problem, and I moved up to South Beach. So if there's anybody here that recognizes me, or, you know, I want to make the amends right here. If you were on the road between November 1981, anywhere from Santa Maria to Atascadero, through January 1987, when I took another geographic back down to Los Angeles, because then South Beach was the problem. And that beautiful beach was overrated. I'd gone back to school 3 times, dropped out 3 times, was waiting tables, doing the same stuff up in South Beach that I've been doing in LA for the last 6 years. Lying, cheating, blackouts on driving, you know, waiting to be arrested on Shell Beach Road at Spyglass. You know, I remember that night so clearly. I just moved up here. We were driving back in from San Luis Obispo. I got off on Shell Beach Road driving my lowered Monte Carlo that I'd come up from LA in. And my friend Tracy was in the car with me. And there's the light. I pulled over, I'm like, oh boy. Because, you know, it was one of those nights where, like, I am really messed up tonight. Like, there's no question. And I got out of the car and they gave me the field sobriety test. And I'm, like, thinking to myself, I'm going to jail. You know, like, I'm kind of, like, accepted the reality. I'm going to jail. And so I'm standing there and he goes, stand right here next to the car. And he goes over to the car and he talks to Tracy. And apparently Tracy convinced him that she was okay to drive. It was 1981. We were young. We were cute. So he puts me in the back, instead of arresting me, he puts me in the back seat of the Monte Carlo. Tracy gets in the driver's seat, and they follow us 3 blocks over to Wawona, and Tracy parked the car and let us go into the house. So that was one of several situations where I walked away from jail. I'm not saying it was a good thing. I think it's just the way my story went, you know, and I don't give credit to God for that. It was just the circumstance and a part of my story. So I was up here doing that, and I finally decided, you know, Shell Beach is overrated. I was struggling financially. I'd been offered a job at a big law firm down in Los Angeles. I moved back down to LA in January of 87. And I will tell you, for those 3 months, 3 months prior to getting sober that year, you know, it looked okay. I had, the first time I heard Chapter 3, when I walked into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, all the things we do when we're trying to recapture our lives, maybe get the drinking back on track, straighten out all the problems. And I do have a story where sometimes I would move forward a little bit. The book describes me when it says, always followed by a worse relapse. And each relapse that I experienced got worse and worse and worse. The book talks about me when it says, my life was, I was in full flight from reality. You know, the book talks about being a mental defect. I remember my first sponsor pointing that out and circling it, and I took offense to it a little bit, because she was calling me defective. And, you know, as I stuck around, I can tell you, I realized that I was living in full flight from reality all those, for many, many, many years behind my alcoholism. That, you know, I could not differentiate the truth from the false. It describes me perfectly when it talks about that. You know, so I go back down to LA. Oh, and all the other things that I'm doing, like I took on physical exercise. Chapter 3 talks about physical exercise. I became a runner up here. You know, I kind of went back to my roots of athleticism, and I started running everywhere. And I was doing a lot of 10Ks up here, and everything seemed like it ended at a winery. So I'd be training. I was always training for the next 10K, and then it ends at a winery, and there's bananas and oranges, cute guys, and wine, right? And so that day, I'm drinking, you know, I've taken a few days off to train, and then I'm ready to drink again, and then be blasted, and then find the next victim, my next boyfriend, and then a lot of dates. when I was doing races. And then my reading inspirational books, I really got into that. My two were Fit for Life, because it was really about trying to make myself look good on the outside, so I'm tan, I'm blonde, I'm running, and now I'm food combining, so I have this really great digestive tract. And just talk about in full flight from reality. Meanwhile, I'm counting back. Did you guys know they don't make 151 anymore? I just heard this in a meeting the other day. I was horrified. I feel so bad for people that are still drinking. But I mean, I would start the night out on tequila, go to 151. So right after I finish the race, like, I'm on it again, you know. And then Fit for Life is food combining. And the big book that was kind of my little big book before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous was a book called Women Who Love Too Much. And it was a book written by a woman to blame all the men in her life for all the problems she's ever had, including her dad, which I've been doing for a long time. Okay, I got to get sober now, you guys. So I was doing all sorts of stuff. And I went down to L.A., got an apartment, I got a new job, I'm making money again. I really thought money was the issue. If I could make enough money, my problems would be solved. There's always something else. I was always trying to fill that God-shaped hole in my spirit, the spiritual malady. And so I'm running, and I was living in East Hollywood near Los Feliz, and I've got, you know, I'm doing the deal. I'm okay for about a month and a half. And then I hit that place that the book describes so perfectly. I mean, it came on me so fast I didn't know what hit me. The book describes where I was living the last couple of months. I was down in Los Angeles. You know, my disease was eating me up from the inside. And, you know, I always say I was not a suicidal type. I veer more towards homicidal. Like, I start fights behind bars when I'm really drunk, or if I think if you're flirting with my boyfriend, or you're flirting with, I'm looking for a fight. Like, if you're flirting with somebody else's boyfriend, I'm going to start a fight with you. And but in the last couple months I was out there, it's described on top of 152 when it says, we come to a place where we cannot live with or without alcohol. I knew that if I didn't drink, I was gonna hurt myself. But if I drank, I was gonna hurt me or somebody else. You know, alcohol was the thing. In some ways, it was saving my life, and at the same time, it was killing me, and it was gonna kill me. It says, you know, loneliness like so few do. I was always alone. I was always lonely. I always felt separate and apart from. Growing up as a little kid in that alcoholic home, even when I was surrounded by friends, you know, with boyfriends and making money and all that, there was always that sense that I just don't quite fit here. I just don't quite fit here. You know? And it says we come to that jumping off place and we want it all there. And my little brother had gotten sober. He was a heroin addict, and he'd been in and out of NA for a long time. And he took phone calls for me the last couple of months I was out there. And I was in my little apartment in Hollywood, and I'd call him up and say, John, you know, I can't go on. I want to kill myself. I don't know what's wrong with me. And he was such a good example. You know, he never tried to convince me anything more than say to me, Terry. And I told him I was going to kill myself. And I remember 2 weeks before I got sober, he said, before you try killing yourself, why don't you try a meeting with Alcoholics Anonymous? It's really working for me now. He found a good home group up in Northern California. And he was 6 months sober. And, you know, I love that kid so much. And April, two of my friends from San Luis Obispo come down to visit me. Saturday, they were at my house for the weekend. We go out for a lunch. We start drinking. We went out for sushi, and we were going to have a glass of sake, and we were going to call it, like, it was going to be our lunch. Well, we never stopped drinking, so I drank from 12 noon that day till about 4 o'clock in the morning. I was with my friend today who was with me that last night, and she said, maybe you should tell him that your last drink of your drunk when you were drinking was Opus 1. She had and I don't know if that means anything to anybody. She pulled it up on her phone today. She goes, this is $400 a bottle of wine right now. Anyway, you know, it didn't matter to me, though, right? I went through the wine connoisseur thing. I never quite understood how smelling it and swishing it around in your mouth. I mean, like, it was such a waste of time. You know, just let me knock it back and get on to my 151, you know. But, yeah, I was ready to go. And he said, before you do that, try meeting. And I went out that night, and we drank all night. I found my next boyfriend on the dance floor. I was a windsurfer. He was a surf. He was a sailor. I thought we were going to sail off into the sunset. I was going to be with him for the rest of my life. And guys, this is him. This is the next one. And I came to that. So we closed the bar down. We went to Kathy's house. She cracked open a case of Merlot. I was drinking for 15 straight hours, excessive amounts of alcohol. I'm lucky I even came to that morning. But when I came to at about 5 o'clock in the morning in that stranger's house, and I felt like I was dying. I physically felt like I was dying. I felt like, yeah, I thought I was dying. And I could smell the alcohol. I could smell tequila oozing out of my pores. My hair was all matted. I slithered into that guy's bathroom, and I had my moment, you guys. After 19 years of drinking, the last several years, it was so hard to be who I was, the way I felt, the way I saw things. And of course, my drinking, everything had just gotten worse and worse and worse. My reaction to life, the way I metabolized the alcohol, the amounts I drank. I had no regard for anybody. I was a liar. I was a cheat. I broke hearts. I broke promises. That's the way I did not like. I was so ashamed of the person I had become, but I didn't know what to do with it. I couldn't stop. And this morning I slid into the bathroom and I looked at myself in the mirror, and it was like an out-of-body experience where I was kind of hovering. This is the true story. It was like I was looking at myself. I could see myself looking in the mirror, and I looked awful and I felt worse. Not a vision for you. And the tears were rolling down my cheeks, and out of my mouth came my prayer. It was, God, please help me. I can't live like this anymore. Now, I got picked up that morning, taken back to my apartment. My girlfriends went back up to San Luis Obispo. It is virtually impossible to be as sick as I was and not take a drink. As a matter of fact, I've always kind of said it was probably a little medically irresponsible for me not to. Because in November of 1986, my dad, who I'd been a horrible daughter to, by the way, for a long time, because I was so angry, I found out once I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, my dad didn't have any chance in the way that his parents and his absenteeism to the very thing that meant everything to him, which was his daughter and his son. You know, he didn't have a choice. He never made it to Alcoholics Anonymous. But in November of 1986, he was trying to get into a rehab down in San Diego. And before they got to him to check him out, the doctors, he had a seizure. He went into a coma. And 2 weeks later, we were saying goodbye to my dad that way. And that's how sick I was that day. You know, that's why I say it was probably a little medically irresponsible for me to not have one. I don't know why it was my time that day, but it was an absolute miracle that I wasn't drinking. And what was even more of a miracle was that as bad as I needed a drink, I didn't even have to battle it. It was done. I was done. My miracle was in full motion. So, Derek, you know, I'm glad you're here. And I hope that you stay in the middle and go after it right now. You know, you've been given that grace, and you've been kind of set through that window of opportunity, I believe. It's just my opinion. You know, I don't know what your story is, but you don't have to go back out if you don't want to, I hope. And you know, my friend in Philly always says, I don't know if it's your time, but I think it's your time if you're here. It's all going to be about how you're going to respond to the gift that's sitting in front of you right now, and this nice group of people with all this sobriety. What a great group on a Saturday night, you know. Okay, so I made it home, and I sat there. And the way I remembered, I just sat there, and I was oozing booze out of my pores, and I felt like I was dying. I took a couple showers. I didn't call anybody. I don't remember talking to anybody on the phone. I don't remember doing anything, just sitting there. And about 5 o'clock in the evening, I heard a voice. I heard a voice, and it said, call AA. Now, I don't know if I was revisiting that conversation I had with my little brother 2 weeks before that, or if God was talking to me, and it doesn't really matter, because God's always working through people, right? God's always working through people. That's it, man. It happens all the time. And I walked over to my big fat phone book. Remember, April 1987, we had those big fat phone books. And I thumbed through it, and I found Alcoholics Anonymous. And right next to that, I had this big landline, and I picked it up, and I'm dialing the number. And I was dialing Los Angeles Central Office. And the woman picked up the phone. And she said, you know how we talk about when you walk into the rooms and there's greeters and their eyes are bright and their teeth are big and white and they're, hi, welcome. Well, she was kind of doing that through the phone. And she said, Alcoholics Anonymous, how can I help you? And my mouth said these words, which was, I need to find a meeting. She goes, honey, call the right place. She goes, there's a meeting at 6:30 tonight down at Kaiser Sunset. would you like us to send somebody to get you? And I'm like, we also talk about how the newcomers come into the rooms and we go, no, get away from me. And so she said, you want somebody to pick you up? Because they used to do that in the old days. And I said, oh, no, I've got a car, thanks. So that night, I took the longest 2-mile drive I've ever taken in my life and the most important drive I've probably ever taken in my life. And I ended up down at the Kaiser Sunset, and I found the room, and I walked into this little tiny round-robin candlelight meeting, and I walked in and I sat down. And what I remember about that meeting was that when it came time for me to say anything, I don't know if I was just parroting what you guys were saying, or it kind of was, and I said, my name is Terry, and I'm an alcoholic, and as it came out of my mouth, I can tell you now, I remember thinking, there's something that makes sense there, and then I started to bawl, and I heard the next most important thing, not just me saying that, then it was the guy sitting next to me and patted me very gently on the shoulder, and he used my name, and he said, Terry, you're going to be okay now that you're an Alcoholics Anonymous. I went 5 days before I went to my next meeting, you guys. I went home that night. I detoxed in my apartment. There were not as many rehabs. I had a job. I was on my own. I needed my job. I think I'd call out sick 2 or 3 days. I can't really remember. And then I went back to work, and it was Friday, and I started to feel a little bit more human again. And I went to work, and I came home, and I had been going for runs on Friday nights, long runs, and then I'd start my weekend drinking. And instead of going on the run, I opened up the phone book and I called Alcoholics Anonymous and I went to my next meeting. They told me there's a meeting at Kaiser Sunset. It starts at 8:30. It was We Agnostics. And that Friday night, We Agnostics became my first home group meeting. And that's the night when I heard that there was a speaker. She shared for 20 minutes and then there was participation. And I heard that gal, Liana, pretty little girl from South America, she had 9 months sober, and she talked about that pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization and how horrible she had felt. And she came into the room, and she was sober, she had a sponsor, and she was happy and I wanted it. And that night, she walked me over to the woman that would become my first sponsor. She said, hi, I'm Ileana, let's go thank Jan. And she walked me over to Jan, and she said, Jan, this is Terry. And she's like, hey, and I'm like, thank you. And then Ileana says, Terry needs a sponsor. Well, first of all, I hadn't said that. I had no idea what a sponsor was. So she was just like putting words in my mouth. And then Jan said to me, is that true, Terry? Do you need a sponsor? And out of my mouth, I said, yes, without knowing anything about what I was saying yes to. And she said, I'd be happy to sponsor you. She said, but I'm going to ask you to do some things, and they're not going to be negotiable. Do you think you can do them? And out of my mouth came yes. I had no idea. She could have asked me to run down Sunset Boulevard naked, go stand on my head on the corner. I don't know what she was going to ask me. I'd never been to Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know what the big book was. I didn't understand what alcoholism was. I knew I had a little problem with drinking, but I didn't understand that I have a spiritual malady, you know, that I have a mental obsession, you know, and that alcohol is how I treat it. And I have that physical allergy that puts me in a whole lot of extra trouble besides the really skewed perception that I have. And by the way, the reason I started off my talk off kind of telling you a few things that I do today, because I still have alcoholism. It's not alcoholism. So I'm 37 and a half years sober, and I have had so many opportunities in my sobriety to be reminded, oh yeah, I'm still alcoholic. And I do have, am I supposed to start at, stop at 9:25 with, okay, I'll do that. I'm going to talk real quick here and talk about a few things that have happened. I got married in sobriety. I wanted to be a good partner. I did not know how to have a good relationship with anybody. I'm a liar. I'm a cheater. I'm the kind of girl that sets up the next relationship. I'm cheating on you. Then I break up on you. And you never hear the truth. I break hearts. I break promises. I married this great guy in sobriety. Okay? I dated for the first time in my second year of sobriety. I've run out of time. I wish I could tell you about the little bit of dating I did in my first 90 days. Big mistake. My sponsor, when she heard that I was going to go out with this dude in my home group, she said, first of all, you have nothing to bring to a relationship. You're going to bring all of your old thinking from the way you lived your whole life and your toxicity and put it on somebody. Mistake. And she said, by the way, you couldn't have picked a sicker guy than the one you just picked to go out with. He was a musician, he was cute, He was charming and funny, and he was living on a trust fund. I could not figure out what he meant by picking the wrong. What's wrong with that? Anyway, it was bad. And I surrendered to the idea that I wasn't a student, and I finished my steps, and I started dating, and I married a super nice guy. Not in the program, a nice guy. He was not an alcoholic. What I went through, God, how fast can I squeeze this? I'm going to tell you about a couple things that were real hard for me. In October of 2019, you're pregnant, right? Yeah, congratulations. I didn't want kids. I used to think they were going to be expensive and noisy and messy and loud and time-consuming. I have two. They are. I was right about that. Maybe you already have one. But, you know, next to what I do in Alcoholics Anonymous and my sobriety, my boys that are now 30 and 27 are everything to me. I have the best relationships with them. They're proud of me. They love me. And they do anything for me, and I'd lay down on training track for them. Tell you, that's the God off. That's the truth. Right before the pandemic, well, in October of 2019, I found out after 29 years of marriage that my husband wasn't happy in our marriage. And there were some circumstances tied into it that made me really angry. And I told you, I kind of lead the homicides, you know? Let me tell you why I need a sponsor. Well, he came over one night, and we were talking about this. I thought we were going to reconcile over the holidays, and we went to some therapy way too late. Nothing against therapy. Maybe it's worked for some people. It wasn't working for us. And 2 weeks before the pandemic, he moved out. So I went into the pandemic on my own, by myself in my house. Now, the beautiful thing is the way Alcoholics Anonymous came together, and we were all living on Zoom, right? Meetings all day long, big conferences all weekend long, 24/7. It was beautiful. And it had all these women I was sponsoring. And everybody runs out of things to do when you're on lockdown, so they all start working steps. I was the lucky recipient of so many great steps, and this is how God works with me. God's given me these girls to work with because that's where my strength tends to be, is it's more of a one-on-one small environment. I get to hear all these fifth steps. It was God working through those fifth steps to help me find surrender, acceptance, work my own steps so I can see my part and what went wrong in our marriage. We drifted, you know. I was able to forgive. And what I will tell you is that man and I, although we did not reconcile the marriage actually, and it really affected my kids, particularly my younger kids. He moved to Colorado and was really mad at his dad for the circumstances, the whole thing. And they were all worried about their mom. My kids were worried about their mom. We have gone full circle. Today, people see us on Facebook together celebrating birthdays or holidays, taking trips to see our son. He asked me to go home and go back to the island, the big island, to say goodbye to his beautiful mother, my beautiful mother-in-law, when she was passing. You know, and Alcoholics Anonymous saved our family. He and I are best friends all over again. We've sort of had this new experience together over the last almost 5 years. That's the gift of Alcoholics Anonymous. And my boys don't have to be mad at him. They love their dad so much. He's a great guy. Still a great guy. You know, and I went through that. August 2022, Sunday night, 28th of August, I'm laying in bed watching TV, and I get a phone call. San Bernardino Sheriff. What is your relationship to John Cooper, my brother? We found your brother, and he's dead. And that little brother that was my SMO coming in had a really good program for 15 years, and he went out, and he great at making money because money, property, and prestige really started to drive him, and he was fabulous at making tons of money. But the disease came back and got him in a chokehold, and he lost everything. He went through four marriages, broke the relationship with his son, and died alone of this disease. And that was the tragedy I was referring to. And let me tell you something. I've seen that. I've sponsored women that have died. I lost my dad to this disease. I lost my mother at 6.5 years the same way to this disease. Then I lost my baby brother to this disease. And I'll tell you, that door doesn't swing both ways. You know, it just does not. Take your gift and hold on to it, Derek. So I'm just about out of time. I have to share that stuff. I hate to, and I'm going to be really kind of stopping here on kind of an odd note, but it's important for me to remember where I come from. I don't ever want to forget where I was that, what I hope will always be that last night that I drank. I don't, you know, there's yes out there for me. You know, but it is not the fact that I haven't had a drink for 37 and a half years. And I think I'll close with this. It is the fact that I've been willing for 37 and a half years to be actively sponsored, to have a sponsor that cares more about the journey I'm on spiritually than she does my feelings. To be willing to be divinely inconvenienced to help somebody, which is what I was doing last night at Impact. I got in the sponsor up at Impact. It's not the easiest way to sponsor people, but you know what? She asked for help. I know that's God saying, Terry, step it up again. Go to Impact. Do your step what's up there. Go pick her up for all the meetings we're going to take her to. Get ready to get busy, right? And it's the work I'm willing to do on a daily basis. 10, 11, and 12. You know, the reading today was about we have to keep looking at ourselves. I have a very strong meditation and prayer practice on a daily basis. I do a written 10-step. Over the last few years with everything I've been through, I've had to really step it up, and I was willing to work harder. There is always more that I can do that's going to enlarge this journey. This is a journey of spiritual experiences, and I get to have this grace. I get to have the joy, the zest for living that I have. You know, I've been, you know, I have such a good life, but I've gone through some tough stuff, but I have never had to do it alone, you know. And just, you know, my life is fun, you know. I'm still running. I've been playing softball for 37 years. Surfing lessons. I'm a birder and a photographer. These are just some of the things I love to do. I just walked through a cancer diagnosis, cancer surgery. I was supposed to be here in August, but I was recovering from my cancer surgery. I am cancer-free, I'm happy to report. You know, everything, and I just want to close with this, everything that I have been through, I mean the good, the bad, and the in-between, you know, the tough stuff that I've gone through, if I'm willing to lean into Alcoholics Anonymous and not hide under the covers on the days when I'm so terrified, I thought, if I come out of this surgery with a bag on my hip, I'm going to be pissed. You know, and that's not what happened. Sometimes it happens. It didn't in my case. How am I going to play softball with a bag on my hip? That's what I was thinking, you know. But the stuff that I have gone through, by leaning into Alcoholics Anonymous, it has built this relationship with this higher power that has always been with me. But I have to do the work to continue to seek that power on a daily basis. And with that, I have stories to tell. This, you know, page 8 of As Bill Sees It, it says, this program will work under any and all conditions, whatever, if I'm willing to do the work. Thankfully, I'm here, and I continue to be willing. And I hope we all stay, and we all keep doing the work. And for new people, keep coming back. This is the most amazing journey you can't even imagine. And happy birthday to everybody, and thanks for having me.
Give her another round of applause.